I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Curzon Film Podcast. I'm Jake Cunningham, and with me this week to talk about Francis Lee's God's Own Country is Irena Musumeci.
Hello.
And Ryan Hewitt.
Hello.
A nice, clean, rehearsed introduction. Okay, so what have we been watching this week?
This week I watched Life by Daniel Espinosa, the film starring Jake Gyllenhaal, Ryan Reynolds and Rebecca Ferguson. That is quite an unashamed riff on Alien and lots of other things. It's a really very derivative film, but it's actually pretty fun. It's actually really fun. And although there is a kind of a moment in there when you get a little bit ambivalent about whether you want to continue, because you can see, right, okay, we've got a very cunning, lethal life force, and we know that we're going to spend the next half of this film with people trying to blast it into space and things like that. By the end is marvellous, and it absolutely earns any kind of obvious play-by-play stuff from before. It just all pays off with that ending, which is I can't go near it because it's a huge spoiler.
Yeah, that's it. Really, but it's great. You say that because I absolutely hated that ending.
You hated the ending?
Yeah.
Excellent. Oh, the ending is brilliant. Yeah,
it was so such an easy way out, and it was so signposted.
It's not completely unexpected.
Yeah.
But I like that they went there. I like that they did it though. Mm. And I try not to give anything away. And a film with such big stars, I think there was a certain daring in it.
Yeah, in that respect, you don't get many films that are in such close quarters that have really huge Hollywood names actually just talking to each other in that situation much anymore. It's always got to be like big sprawling landscapes and cities and jumping all over the place, and seeing them in that restriction was quite nice.
I agree, yeah, and seeing a cast of a kind of sort of equal players as well. They're all, well, relatively A-list, maybe slightly B-list for a few of them, but there's not too much battle between a lead. It's very, apart from like people getting picked off in certain orders, but even that's done with a hierarchy based on who they are and what their star status is. It's quite nice to see them not.
There's a nice twist on that about who you might expect to last and who doesn't. And the opening is really good as well, where you've got this faked one take, like through the space station, outside and back in again, and that's really neatly done.
Yeah.
As you can tell, I haven't actually seen this film. But divisive films are my favourite thing.
Yeah. All that ending. You'll need to see that ending.
I watched something that I think is going to be completely undivisive in that it's brilliant, widely entertaining, appealing to a wide range of people. And it's I was lucky enough to get an early industry preview of Borg versus McEnroe, which is going to be coming to our cinemas 22nd of September. And it's... It's fantastic. It's a combination of a great sports drama that does exactly all of the steps that you need from it. It gives you, you know, the struggle of a sportsman. It gives you the cheer at the end. And it really made me forget the outcome of the eventual final battle between the two heroes, you know. It also is an excellent character study of the both of them. And I think quite interestingly, it's quite evenly balanced in that you basically root for both of them, and you almost wish tennis wasn't as harsh a sport, that there doesn't have to be one winner at the end. Plus, I think it's a really intense and very interesting psychological analysis of what happens in the mind of a tennis player, which is a very, very peculiar kind of madness, or, you know, something verging on a kind of obsessive mental illness. It's something that Andre Agassi really goes into in his amazing autobiography Open, and it's really about the kind of dedication and the loneliness of a tennis player. And you get this clash between Borg, who is clearly, you know, pitted as ice. He's the ice king of the tennis pitch. He's totally cool. He's in charge of his emotions all the time. He's almost verging on having no emotions, against McEnroe, played absolutely superbly by Shia LaBeouf, in an incredible piece of casting, who is hot-headed, angry, full of expletives. He's like a volcano. He's on fire all the time. You don't know what he's going to do next. And so this big clash of like ice and fire to rival Game of Thrones and no zombies in sight.
Great. So we've got to talk about God's Own Country this week. So we've got Francis Lee and Alex Acoriani, who plays Georgi in the film, to come and chat with us in a bit. So we'll play that for you. But let's have a quick chat and talk about what God's Own Country is about.
So God's Own Country is a coming-of-age story. It's the story of a young farmer called Johnny who lives in a farm in Yorkshire. He lives with his dad and his nan. There's a kind of question mark as to what happened to his mother and whether there was anyone else in the family. And he's kind of a bit out of control, like most teenagers who are trying to figure out who they are and what they want from life. I think it's probably the first film I've ever seen that sounds with the start of someone being violently sick.
Yeah.
Because Johnny drinks a lot, and it's kind of his favorite pastime. When he's not working on the farm, he goes out to a local pub, gets very drunk, and you get a sense there is something that's not very settled about him. And the story kind of kicks off when it's basically lambing season, and dad is unwell, cannot help on the farm. So they call in a worker who happens to come from Romania. He is the only person who responded to an advert for a farmhand. He comes in. His name is Giorgio, and he's meant to stay there for a week. And essentially the encounter with him changes Johnny's life pretty much. It's a love story. It's a very beautiful rural love story, in that landscape plays a very, very important part, as well as nature. And it's a very intense and extraordinary piece of work, actually, I would say. It's by a debut filmmaker called Francis Lee. Very, very impressive and assured in his first feature.
Great. So let's talk to Francis Lee and Alex Acoriani, who plays Giorgio in the film. So we're delighted to welcome Francis Lee and Alex Acoriani from God's Own Country onto the Curzon Film Podcast this week.
Hello, thank you. Hello. Really, really pleased to be here.
Thanks so much for coming on. So from very early on in the film, we can tell that this is a very personal film. There's inspiration from your own experiences here, Francis. But it's also a story of what might have been for yourself as well. Is that right?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, it's really not autobiographical. Apart from the landscape, the kind of the way in which the central character reacts to the landscape and has to learn to love it and accept it, what feels very autobiographical. Johnny isn't me. No, nobody in the film is an extension of me, really, and the family really aren't mine. I have to say that because I think my family would be really upset if they thought I was representing them with these characters.
And there's a character who comes back from her reading week at university and meets Johnny. And you left Yorkshire, went to college. When you returned, whether that was on holiday or afterwards, did you find that your vision of Yorkshire as a county had changed?
Yeah, Yeah, no, totally. It was a really odd experience because I moved to London to go to college when I was 20 and came here, and for the first term, or for quite a long time, didn't feel to fit in London. I didn't feel that, you know, it felt like a natural home, or that I had a natural affinity with the urban landscape. And then I'd go home and I felt like I'd changed, and my perception of Yorkshire was different. And so I ended up feeling like I didn't really have a home at that point. I felt like really caught between two stools.
Mm. And Alec, for yourself, I suppose as a portrait of England, Yorkshire's quite unique. It's what was your first perspective of as Yorkshire compared to the rest of the country as well?
Well, to be honest, I didn't know what to expect. That was my first time in Yorkshire. So it was supposed to be spring. I mean, we started to film in spring and I was expecting to be spring, and because I'm used to Romanian spring when the weather starts to get warmer and the nature is greener, but that was not the case at all in Yorkshire, because we had four seasons in one day. It was hailing and snowing and storming and
sunshine
for 5 minutes,
don't,
and then
the sunshine
and then all over again. Yeah, it was pretty intense, and it was rough and muddy and cold and wet, but that of course that helped us a lot, because the nature and the landscape, as Francis said, has a big role in this film.
Okay, and Francis, you kind of gave the guys a bit of a baptism of fire into Yorkshire farming life before the cameras, well before the cameras started rolling.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, for me, I wanted this film to be totally authentic and truthful. I always knew I never wanted a stunt double or a hand double, because I love being immersed myself in stories and watching cinema, and anything that can pull me out of that, I have difficulty with. So I knew I wanted the boys to do all the detailed farming work. So for 2 weeks, I sent them off to work on farms, and they would do very long shifts. They would start 6 in the morning and they would work till 6-7 at night. And they did everything. They learned how to birth lambs. They learned how to look after the animals, dry stone wool. Alec learned how to make cheese, because Georgi makes cheese in the movie. And they became incredibly proficient at handling the animals and incredibly skilled at doing the farming work. But it also, what happened was that landscape got into their bones. They got cold, they got wet, they got miserable. They realised how hard it was, and that really affected their characters physically as well as emotionally. So it worked. I know it was hard for the boys, but it worked so well for the truth of the film.
Mm. And I suppose, Alec, you're thankful for those nice 2 weeks of freezing animal delivery and cheese making.
Well, I am thankful because they paid off in the end. But it was so strange, those 2 weeks, because I was living in a hotel, and every night I went to the hotel, I was smelling like manure, and it was, and everybody was looking at me, what is he doing here? Yeah, but of course it helped us a lot with the physicality of the characters, and it helped us when we filmed it, because we had to really know how to control the animals, because they tend to be unpredictable, and it was very helpful to be in control on set and to really know what we have to do on when we film. Yeah.
And Francis, you mentioned about not wanting body doubles, but specifically hand doubles, and that's something that I really picked up on the film, is that there's this real focus on hands.
I mean, personally, I'm obsessed by hands. It's probably the first thing I notice about people and how they use their hands. In fact, when I first met Josh O'Connor, who plays Johnny so brilliantly, I was mesmerised by his hands, because he's got these huge meat plate hands that work so well for the character and for the world as well. This isn't a world where people verbally communicate, really. And so I wanted to create a world where you know, touch, feel, was how they communicated, and how that changes as they change as characters. And that felt very emotional to me. There felt to be a strong emotional truth with that.
Yeah, there's a lot of, like, just there's moments of connection through fingers touching each other that are so powerful in this film in particular.
Great.
And There's a few sounds that I picked up on, where there's the weather, the wind, belts. There's a moment where Alec, you open a biscuit packet, a bourbon, and those moments are amazing to watch. They feel so real. But it seems like a mad thing to make feel real, but it felt like...
Yeah, it's sound is incredibly important to me. It's as important as the visuals, and sometimes more so. I have incredibly sensitive hearing, and this sound design of the film was very painstakingly crafted and orchestrated to make it as immersive as possible. I sent my brilliant sound designer off up to Yorkshire for long periods of time, and Joss recorded hours and hours and hours of atmospheres. So when I went into the edit, I had, you know, hundreds of different wind sounds to build, to choose from, to try and add to the emotion or to the characters. All the birds are very specifically chosen and placed for their meaning or their significance, and all the other birds had to be taken out of the sound design. It was very detailed and precise, just to add more emotion, more depth, more layering, I just feel sound is an incredible tool for storytelling.
And you use the sound to really capture this portrait of Yorkshire so well. But what I thought was really interesting is Yorkshire is a stunningly beautiful place, and it would be so easy to just go out and do landscapes all the time. But we don't really get a big, wide moor landscape.
You get one.
Yeah. But that then feels momentous.
Again, it was about representing this world as I saw it, and I'd seen lots of films shot in Yorkshire that all did what you say. They were big, wide, expansive landscape shots, and I never experienced it like that. I didn't go out into the countryside in that sense and consume it in that way. To me, the landscape was always affecting me, so I wanted to keep the camera very tight and see the landscape's effect on the characters. So you see the mud, you know, you see the mud under their fingernails, or the mud they're walking through, or the wind, you know, in their hair or their faces. And I knew I didn't want to see this landscape until we as a viewer experience it through Johnny's eyes for the first time, as it were.
Yeah. And Johnny, I suppose the film is a man of few words, and when he does speak, it's at times pretty idiomatic as well. How much of that dialogue and dialect was scripted? And because there's moments in there that...
All of it.
Boringly, I'm really precise and controlling. So none of the actors, but specifically the boys, were not allowed to improvise dialogue at all. I wanted them to say the words as written. And the script actually is incredibly detailed, so everything you see on screen was in the script, and I think that's just because I think because there are such few words in the film, what words there are really important. They're important that they're right, and that's why I was very precise about them. And the only thing that happened in the edit really was we got rid of more of the lines. So we started off with not many lines, and then we got rid of more in the edit because the boys were communicating so incredibly well without the language.
So, Alec, when you're reading the script for those scenes that do go on silently, what kind of direction are you getting from the script, and then what are you getting from Francis on set?
As Francis said, for me it was, I think, the most detailed script that I've ever read, and every single glimpse and gesture and look and touch, it was written in the script. And even the scenes that have no dialogue, they were very, very explicit and very detailed in the script. So that really got you a sense of how these characters work and how do they connect, and how important the body language is, and everything was there, and yeah, it was so helpful to create a bigger picture of what's happening in the story.
And was there any points that you struggled with the Yorkshire dialect?
Well, I think for me it was helpful that I read the script before, because, I mean, yeah, it was helpful that most of the lines were, all of the lines were written, so I could really understand what they're saying. But even if I'm in A Bep and the Brew, you can understand where...
Alec?
A Bep and the Brew. You can understand what's that about. I mean, even if you're not from Yorkshire, you can be intuitive about it and you can understand it. It's not that far from regular English, I think.
A sandwich and a cup of tea.
Sandwich and a cup of tea.
And now, so your character, Gheorghe, he kind of isolates himself from his country by leaving, and Johnny is alienated himself through his own isolation in Yorkshire. So, in a way, both characters, they've taken wildly different paths in their choices, but they're ultimately two sides of the same coin as well.
Yeah, I think so. It was really important that these two characters were like mirrors, I guess, and that they had, in a sense, a similar background and a similar experience, but had responded very differently to that. And then it was about, you know, how were they going to make this work, if it was going to work.
And from your own experiences, Alec, I don't know whether, like, was there anything that you could see as a touchstone for research for the...
Well, yes, in fact I did. In fact, I did. I mean, when we started working with the character, that happened, I think, 2 months before we started shooting, 2 or 3 months, and I did a Skype with Francis, and he started to ask me about a lot of things about the character, about his family, about his village, about his other relationships, studies, friends, and how did he end up in England. And I did my research in Romania, and of course I talked to some people that came to the UK to work, and the experiences that they have been through. And I kind of understood why Gheorghe wanted to be by his zone and working in the countryside, because that is the only environment that he can relate to and he really can attach to. Because most of the Romanians that are coming to England to work, they're working constructions, they stay 10 people in one bedroom apartment, and the conditions are not so good. And I can understand why Gheorghe tries to make it on his own.
There's a real difference in the way that both Johnny and Gheorghe approach space, in that Johnny feels he's got all of this land around him and he just feels like he's completely imprisoned by it. Whereas as any, like for me, as a tourist, if I went up to Yorkshire, I would do as you did in one scene where you run to the top of a hill and you look out.
It's really interesting. Again, it was about looking at the experience of what that landscape can mean. You know, yes, in one sense it is incredibly beautiful and dramatic, but in another sense it's brutal and isolating and difficult. And that was what was so interesting, I think, about these two characters that you were just talking about, that they have very different viewpoints, but by coming together, in a sense, they kind of become a whole thing, as it were.
And so when I think of, not that there are a wealth of them, but great romantic sheep farmers.
Name them.
I can name my one is Gabriel Oak.
Okay,
from,
yeah.
Far from the Madding Crowd.
Yeah.
And I wonder if he had any influence here.
No.
None at all.
No. I'm so sorry. I don't really read, so I'd never read the novel. And have I seen the film? I don't think I have. I might have seen the newer version.
Yeah.
But I don't remember it. But no. No, because... No. This experience, I think, or Gheorghe and Johnny were very much about looking at people from a very personal, emotional point of view. That famous sheep farmer wasn't an influence.
Well, that Madding Crowd last, or 2 years ago maybe, that was Thomas Vinterberg of Dogma, who you almost took a Dogma approach to costume and props for this as well, didn't you?
I mean, I don't fully understand what that term means. Mm. I'm not a cinephile, and I never went to film school or, you know, learned how to direct or write or anything, but I knew that I, as again, wanted this story to be totally rooted within that, the geography of the world. And so my costume designer, Sean Jenkins, insisted that she could only buy the costumes for the family who live on the farm in the shops they actually geographically had access to, which in real terms meant two shops in Keighley. I'm a big fan of rules.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Because I think with rules, that you if you limit yourself, it pushes you creatively. So every department had rules, and we stuck to them.
I think you'd enjoy Dogma.
Though. Okay, great. Yeah. I'm gonna
10 rules to live by.
Okay.
Well, Francis, Alec, thank you so much for joining
thank
us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, God's Own Country focuses on these sheep farmers, Johnny and Gogi. So it made me think about kind of other film sheep farmers and sheep, which I do touch on in the interview that mentioned Gabriel Oak from Far From the Madding Crowd, who I was surprised to find out was not a influence on this film, when particularly looking at Matthias Schoenaerts in Thomas Vinterberg's recent Far From the Madding Crowd, and Gheorghe here, I thought there's got to be something there, but apparently not. It's amazing, and like, I think the niche of sheep in film we thought might be quite small and we might not have a lot to talk about, but turns out there's a lot of
in
sheep
the
out there.
There's a sheep on film.
There's a subculture, there's a kind of fandom of sheep and goats actually in film. But the impression you get from films is that sheep farmers are incredibly handsome, because you know, between Matthias Schoenaerts, Alec is, can we refer to him as Gorgeous Giorgio? I mean, he's
quite happy.
He's pretty, nice piece of objectification there, I'm afraid. One of my favorite farmers in film is Sam Shepard in Days of Heaven. Absolutely handsome, and he puts in this terrific performance as his character, who in another film would be considered underwritten. But here, he absolutely gets the kind of performance style that Terrence Malick really requires from his actors to kind of fill in what may be gaps in dialogue, or perhaps, you know, just kind of imagining voiceovers and all that kind of work, with an incredible sort of facial performance, but also a very, very intense presence. And the late, great Sam Shepard really shows in this film that he's a terrific actor as well as an incredible writer and author of all of the great plays that we are familiar with. Just as a kind of aside, we are celebrating the life of Sam Shepard with a very special screening of The Right Stuff in a couple of weeks' time. It's a very rare film, very rare to get to see it, particularly as we'll be screening it in 35mm, so a nice analog print. And it's the film that Sam Shepard was nominated for an Oscar for, and he plays one of the one member of a large team of guys who were essentially involved in the American side of the space race. The film takes place over 15 years, and his character is quite extraordinary, kind of poised between a very, very tender and vulnerable performance and some extreme testosterone. It's really something to behold. But anyway, let's go back to farms with spaceships and space stations to another conversation.
Yeah, because there's a really good kind of like a few lamb rearing moments here and like shearing. And I was recently watching I Love Dick, the
TV series.
Yeah, the new series. And Andrew Arnold has directed a few episodes of it. And there's a particular moment where Kevin Bacon walks down the street with his top off, just in like the cowboy belt and denim jeans, just holding a lamb. And it's such a great shot.
Yeah.
And then you think of Gabriel Oak in Far From the Madding Crowd bringing a gift of a lamb and just going, I've bought you a lamb.
And women were instantly pregnant.
Yeah.
But like, at that point, the rest of the, in any real world, Far From Madding Crowd would just stop there. Because if Gabriel Oak gives you a lamb, you should say yes. And then, like, that's the end. This can't be top. I don't need anyone else. I don't need Weedy Tom Sturridge or Michael Sheen.
Oh, I don't know. I quite like Michael Sheen. I think he's misunderstood in that film. But, you know, if Michael Sheen brought me a lamb, then my life will be over at that point.
My favourite on-screen farmer is a slightly more farcical entry, I suppose. He's Wash Hog Wallop from the Coen Brothers, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? And played by Frank Colliston, who was just seen in the new series of Twin Peaks, incidentally. And many people will know him from Dr. Quinn, Medicine Woman, which also includes farms. But Wash Hog Wallop is he's a horse farmer, not a lamb farmer. And he looks after his son because Mrs. Hogswallop, as he put it, up an R-U-N-N-O-F-T, leaving him to look after the son and raise his son. And then the three bandits go to his farm and try and get their shackles knocked off. Wash Hogswallop is amazing. He's an absolute joke of a character. He's until The Simpsons go live action, he's the closest we'll ever get to a human rendition of Cletus the Slack-jawed Yokel. It's perfect. He just ludicrous.
And so in the pantheon of great farmers, where do we think Johnny and Georgie stand?
Well, they're certainly the most romantic of a farming duo, I think. It's a really touching relationship that they have. It feels very, very sincere and very tender. And it's a straight-up romance, really. I mean, it's what is interesting about this film, and what I found particularly interesting, is that while it might be pitched in a way that suggests that it is about a relationship between two men, a sexual romantic relationship between two men, which of course it is, it almost doesn't really treat it that way. It's not a coming out story. It's not a story of sexual awakening or realizing that you are, that is how you're attracted, who you're attracted to. It treats them just as two people who happen to both be men and they happen to fall in love with each other.
But there's not a humongous amount of prejudice in the film for their sexuality. And if anything, it comes, when it does appear, it's almost of their own creation as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
In kind of removing societal prejudice, I think the film is making a really, really strong political point. And it's one of those beautiful, kind of the personal is political statements that essentially there are no obstacles to their love and their relationship but themselves and what they decide to put into play to give to each other or to remove from each other at times. And I think that's really important. It just means that love is just about the two people involved. It doesn't have to be about everyone else and what they think.
Yeah.
And so it's a really strong statement, I think, to make at this time. And in this, it reminded me a lot of Andrew Haig's Weekend, in that there's this great focus on just these two characters and their intimacy and how they develop a relationship really out of knowing each other. And there's a lot of unspoken stuff about where they have come from and how they may have got to this place, in the way they, for example, own the epithets that they may have been called in their youth. Or the experiences they might have had until this point. And really just the moment when they give themselves over to this relationship, which is not there from the off. I mean, it's not given that they'll get on, because their initial encounter is quite confrontational,
well,
particularly.
That's traditional romance.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Like, they're not going to get on. I think they might.
Yeah, exactly. They're sussing each other out in an extremely macho way.
Yes.
A real, like, needling each other and pushing each other. And yeah, like you say, it's really about accepting intimacy from the other. That's the obstacle, isn't it? It's particularly from Johnny. Georgi seems considerably more comfortable with who he is and how he feels about things.
I almost felt like Georgi was another portrait of Johnny, but maybe 5 years in the future, for instance, and that he has worked and he has kind of like accepted himself for who he is and like what he likes doing and what he's good at. And I think he's educating Johnny in a way as well.
There's a great sense of mutual education in terms of emotional intelligence, but also in like kind of really beautiful setting up of nature versus nurture kind of thing. You know, by nature, you may be someone who is confrontational and angry and furious about whatever has happened to you. But then the experience of love, the experience of a relationship does change things. And particularly for Johnny, that's the biggest journey that he kind of embarks on. I have a feeling that perhaps Giorgio starts from a slightly different place in life, the way he talks about his family, particularly his mother. Quite interestingly, she's kind of the only family member that he refers to, and he has a picture of her that he puts up in his caravan. And she seems to be connected with this idea of home, and she taught him English. She's an English language teacher, and his English is extraordinary. the fact that he can understand this very, very thick Yorkshire accent and certain,
and you know, kind of phrase.
I sometimes struggle with this myself. So it's pretty brilliant, and it seems to be a kind of, you know, closeness with his mother, whereas Johnny's mother, we hear that she's left the family at some point, and we don't quite know why. We are really left to make up that backstory if we want to, but in a sense, we don't even need to hear it. And there is perhaps a kind of simpler way of understanding Johnny's character as someone who's really in need of kind of gentle mothering and the kind of care that you get from a lover who is dedicated, but also earlier in life from a parent, particularly a mother. When the father, you know, the father is a very interesting character too, I think, in that he represents a certain kind of masculinity, which is very much entrenched in certain old ways. But at the same time, we're never given that generational conflict. And I think that's really a choice, and it's important. The generational conflict happens in the way they decide to carry on the farm work and Johnny taking ownership of it. It's not a thing like, Dad, I'm gay and we're going to have a big fight about it. So it's very beautiful, really, to do that and to kind of remove that from the picture and make sure that it's really about personality rather than about some issue.
Yeah, and there's not really a lot entrenched in the past that is where we're given the exact information about. Like it's all up for interpretation. There's only real one instance, which is where Johnny goes to the pub and someone that he was friends with who has gone to university has come back from a reading week and they've shared a cigarette outside. And that moment, it's quite clear what I think a lot of what Johnny's issues boil down to is the fact that he has had to stay.
Sense of obligation, yeah, that's placed on him. A lot, his father pushes it on him for the most part. He needs him to... You know, a farm is something that has very few people tend to work on farms, and in order to make them efficient, you need to really work all the time, and that's clearly a burden for Johnny and something that he's reluctant to do. But
what's really interesting for me is that I think that he accepts this challenge. It's not like he wants to go off to university and do something else with his life. That I think the farming career, if it's you know, something like that, it has to be a calling. It's something that I think it's a really tough choice, particularly today, for a young man to decide to go and, you know, stick with a generation's work.
Well, and in years, decades before, perhaps even in the time of his dad, the farm work was community work, and there would have been a lot more people, and in the little village that he seems to be in, would have been connected to the farm in some way, shape or form.
Yeah.
And that has effectively all been outsourced, and as like things are now being made across the world and ending up in supermarkets, and that has been dispersed, that idea of a rural farm community.
Farm feels incredibly isolated, doesn't it? And even to your point about them only getting one call from putting out a job looking for help at hand, there's only one person who comes back to them. They are on their own. It's a father who can't do half of the work. It's one son who has to bear the brunt of all of the work. and which, very few people to come and help.
Yeah, which also brings me to the other great understated political issue in this film, in that to me it's one of the great cases for Remain. It's a great, it's a film that really celebrates the idea of bringing someone in from abroad who has a different way of doing things, who can really bring a different knowledge and a different approach in a way that is enlightening and generally benefiting both parties in the encounter. So it's almost like, what Erasmus did for generations and generations of students, in that, you know, it took you to Europe and to experience other cultures. This kind of work experience for a Romanian farmer who comes in to help this British farm really says there is value, there is great wealth to be derived from this kind of thing. And so it's not hammered in, you know, it's not a film that feels the need to kind of really press this point, but it's very significant that there is one person who answers this call, and it's a person who comes in from abroad. And in a way, what's implied is, if we close up ourselves to this, we end up alone and we cannot actually do the work that's going to sustain us. So it's very beautifully put. I mean, I know that I do go looking for kind of political resonances and contemporary resonances, but I think particularly where farming culture is concerned, there is a great message to be taken from this film. I also want to say something else about community, in that you really do see that kind of community and communal work and the joy of the experience of farming as communal labor in the credits of the film, which are a really significant sequence and very, very beautiful, that sort of brings in all this kind of golden color. And the credits are kind of, it's footage from presumably past harvests in the local area, but it's very striking how the color palette changes, how there is this kind of almost golden age feel about it. And it's actually the only place in the film where you see a lot of women together. The film has two female characters who never meet. They never speak to each other. We are very far from passing the Bechdel test here, but that's kind of, you know, it's kind of gimmicky. It's not what we're here for. But at the same time, this kind of lack of female presence was very striking to me. It's a film that's very economical with its characters. There are essentially only four speaking characters, and very few locations as well. And in being so minimal, it really focuses in on the story. But opening it up in that way at the end really does connect it to something for me. And so I really enjoy that credit sequence. I really enjoy the song that plays on that credit sequence as well, which is a song by Patrick Wolf called The Days, which is very much about the past and the future.
Yeah, it's interesting you point out the, like, seeing life and colour in those images in the credits, because it's not really until post a very intense moment between Johnny and Googie that we actually see a warmer colour palette in the film. It's very much a kind of blue, cold, like, even when there's, like, maybe a fire or something, this just feels absolutely sodden.
Wet and muddy, cold, and freezing. Yeah,
and it's meant to be spring. It's meant to be the great springtime of the north. Winter is coming.
Yeah.
But it's true. It's at that moment. That moment is for me the moment when they fall in love, and it's at that moment that the film also opens up. So the first few sequences up until that kind of very tender. There's a very intense, sort of quite violent and rough lovemaking scene.
You said about being masculine, like that is like fighting. It's
all and there's mud involved. It's very elemental, the way the film treats sex in particular, but also the relationship with animals and nature in general is completely earthy. It's very grounded. There's a lot of instinct and a lot of things that have to do with nature and following the path of nature. But it's at that point that the film, so they have this very rough kind of initial encounter, and then the next time is much more tender, much gentler. And after that, the morning after, they go out for a walk on the hills, and at that point the film opens up. I mean, it's almost like that moment in Xavier Dolan's Mummy, when the kid is on the skateboard and he kind of pulls out the frame of the film with his hands. And at this point, the film really starts to breathe this kind of, you know, liberating, beautiful moment, and they walk on top of the hills, and you see the landscape for the first time, and it's glorious manifestations, really. And there's a lot of weather in this film, which is fantastic. There's a great sound of wind, and for me, that's a really extraordinary. It's a really extraordinary way of conveying a sense of falling in love and really opening yourself up to the experience of it, which sort of reminds me of the idea of pathetic fallacy and how we sometimes experience nature as having almost human feelings. And at that point, there's really this great communion between the landscape and what the characters are experiencing, which is extraordinary.
Well, yeah, Giorgo is very connected to the landscape, much more than we ever see Johnny. He seems much closer to... much more sentimental about the animals that they're looking after, and seems to pass that on to Johnny, perhaps.
I think it's also down to the fact that when you live somewhere that is so commonly regarded as being beautiful, when you actually live in it, you don't think
you take it for granted. Yeah,
and I think Johnny has just been, he's living in this, and he's lived it in the worst weather, doing the worst things on the coldest mornings.
Yeah,
and so actually looking out over the mountains and moors is not something you would have any desire to do anymore, because it's been ruined
by
what he's had to do.
By hardship, But you're right, the moment you speak about when they fall in love, and it's Johnny running after Giorgi, isn't it?
Yes.
It's earlier on we've seen a sexual encounter where the other party, he suggests going for a beer with Johnny, and Johnny says, no, I'm not interested, and he runs away. And you, with that one moment, you kind of know that that's how Johnny deals with relationships and sexual encounters. And this is a time where he is the one running after someone. Mm. He says, where are you going? And he follows him. And you know that he's fallen for Giorgi. And like you say, that's when it opens up. And that's when the film goes into unexpected territory, I think, because up until that point, it could go down a frequently trodden path of repression and I don't know how to deal with my feelings, but it just doesn't do that. Everyone seems quite comfortable with how they are, and it just turns into a romance. It's not about an internal conflict. It's not about realizing that you might, you know, it's nothing clandestine about the way they conduct themselves, really.
Yeah, and I think really in that lies the very unique nature of this film.
Yeah.
That you experience the kind of discovery of tenderness for these two characters, and the fact that they are so concentrated on each other, and the film is really concentrated on the two of them, has the effect of bringing us into their relationship. And so that's, you know, it really brings you closer. You're rooting for them. You're rooting for this to happen. And there's a very deep emotional connection to these two characters, which for me really started at this point. Because what came before, I think I'd seen before, but what comes after, I've not quite seen before.
Yeah.
You know, there's as they return and then they kind of start to play home a little bit, and there's this very kind of loving and nourishing relationship when Giorgio is actually cooking for Johnny.
Or when he makes him pasta.
And
seasons
and salt it.
Yeah.
You know, it's really tender and very touching, and it's that kind of nurturing, gentle, learning how to be with each other story, which, you know, it's a place where I think a lot of reviews will probably point out a comparison with Brokeback Mountain with this film, and obviously I think it's probably a reference for the filmmaker, but it really takes all of our story much further. The two characters in Brokeback Mountain are never really allowed to have this relationship, and you kind of imagine what would have happened for them. I mean, and it's completely... Brokeback Mountain has broken hearts all over the place, but you sort of always wish you could see the happy ending for them. And it's almost like, you know, a few years on, we can do this finally. And so to me, there's a really great unspoken battle there that has been won culturally.
I completely agree. I imagine that there are stories like this being told, but for one to break out the way that this seems to be breaking out is a real step forward for that and representation of that kind of relationship, I think.
Yeah, I think we're all really excited to be able to show this in cinemas and get it out to a bigger audience as well.
Mm.
Right, so that is Francis Lee's God's Own Country, which is on a tour around the country at the moment, but will be playing in Curzon Cinemas nationwide from the 1st of September.
When we also have a Q&A with the filmmaker.
Excellent. So do make sure you come to that. As well as God's Own Country, there's new releases on Curzon Home Cinema. One that I'd like to pick out is just Their Finest, the film with Bill Nighy and Gemma Arterton that came out earlier this year, about a scriptwriter working during the Second World War in England. Because she's a woman and all the men have been sent off to war, she has managed to get into the film industry and is kind of breaking in through this script about Dunkirk, of all things. Who can imagine a film about that? But it's really good, and we spoke to Bill Nighy and Gemma Arterton about the film on this very podcast. So if you want to go back a few months and listen to that and then check out the film, it's on Curzon Home Cinema now. Until next time, it's goodbye from Irena.
Bye.
It's goodbye from Ryan.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.